Hello and welcome once again to this, our final episode in the history of the Catholic Church in the United States. We began, as you remember, back in the colonial period of American history, and we've tried to take the story of the Catholic Church in America right up to approximately 1960, as we were knocking on the door, as it were, of the Second Vatican Council. We've tried to look at the major highlights in United States Catholic history through each one of these periods of time. Today, in our final installment in this course, we want to look at specific individuals from each one of these periods of time who, through the grace of Almighty God, saw the light and came to the fullness of faith, which is Roman Catholicism. That is to say, we want to look at famous converts to the Church in United States Catholic history. Some years ago, there was a very famous convert who came into the Church by the name of Avery Dulles. Dulles was the son of an American Secretary of State in the Eisenhower administration, John Foster Dulles. Avery Dulles became a Roman Catholic, a priest, a Jesuit, and finally he wrote the story of his conversion, and he titled the book, A Testimonial to Grace. When you stop to think of it, each and every conversion to the Catholic faith is precisely that. It is a testimonial to grace, because it is the individual person who has, in some fashion, cooperated with the grace of God to come into the fullness of the Catholic faith. Whether it be people in this country or indeed people in any country, they are all testimonials to grace. Now, as we go back into the early period of United States history, we're reminded of people like Frances Allen, that is Frances with an E. Frances Allen was the daughter of Ethan Allen, the Vermont Revolutionary Patriot. She was a young woman who had grown up in a rather agnostic and anti-Catholic atmosphere, and yet in her young adult life she became a Roman Catholic, and she became a sister, a nun, in the Hotel Dieu convent in the city of Montreal, Canada. She became the first native of New England to enter religious life, to enter a woman's religious community. Another interesting example from early days would be the story of Cornelia Peacock Connolly from the city of Philadelphia. Cornelia Connolly, born into the Protestant faith, married an Episcopalian minister by the name of Pierce Connolly. They were rather happily married for a number of years, devout Christian people, and through a process of reading and thinking, the two of them, as husband and wife, came into the Catholic faith. They lived as a Catholic married couple for some time, and then they made a very unusual decision. They decided, as a married couple mutually, to part. Pierce Connolly would go into the seminary to be ordained a priest. His wife Cornelia would begin her own religious community of women, the Sisters of the Holy Child Jesus. Her life brought her to England, where she set up and presided over a very successful religious community, still very, very much functioning today. Well, the vocation took with Cornelia Connolly. It did not seem to take with Pierce Connolly as well. Pierce Connolly eventually left the priesthood and defected to the Episcopalian faith. The problem was he wanted his wife back after he became an Episcopalian. And she said, absolutely not. She had made her choice in life. She had become a Catholic. She had become a sister. That was her vocation in life. It was not to return to Pierce Connolly as his wife. Well, Connolly took his former wife to court in England. And the English courts took the part of Cornelia Connolly. They judged in her favor. They said that she could indeed remain at the head of her religious community, which she did, and you can visit her grave in Mayfield, England, to this day at the Mother House of the Sisters of the Holy Child Jesus. Pierce Connolly, of course, who had once been a priest, offered his first Mass in Rome in the Church of Trinità dei Monti at the top of the Spanish Steps, died a very, very distraught and dejected man. What an interesting story the two of them were. I suppose one of the best conversion stories known to us in United States history involved a young woman in New York by the name of Betty Bailey. Betty Bailey was the daughter of Dr. Richard Bailey, who was a prominent New York City physician. The Baileys lived very, very well out on Staten Island, and they belonged to the, oh, we'll say the highest class social society in New York. They knew all the greats of New York social life, all the greats of New York political life. And young Betty Bailey, as she was growing up, was an intensely religious young woman in the Episcopalian faith. She became very closely associated with Dr. Henry Hobart. Now, Hobart was the Episcopalian minister who was the rector of Trinity Church on Wall Street. If you go to the famous stock exchange on Wall Street today, you cannot miss Trinity Church. If you're standing on Wall Street, you'll see Trinity Church right up at the top of the hill, and the famous graveyard where many American patriots, such as Alexander Hamilton and the like, are buried there at Trinity Church. Well, Betty Bailey was a very active parishioner there, a very strong devotee of Henry Hobart, who was quite a theological man himself. And Hobart served as a spiritual director for this young woman as she was growing up in New York. She, Betty Bailey, married a young man, a very successful merchant shipper, very successful in the import-export business as well. And the young man's name was William McGee Seton. So I think now most everyone knows who we are talking about, Elizabeth Bailey Seton. They were married in New York, and they became the parents of five children. Once again, they joined into the fashionable New York society. There's a wonderful story told about them. It's really in the realm of legend. We can't prove this to be true. But there is at least a very pleasant legend which says that Mr. and Mrs. Seton, William and Elizabeth Seton, danced the first dance at George Washington's inaugural ball. Now, as I say, that's legend. We can't prove that. We do know that they were at George Washington's inaugural ball. Whether they actually danced the first dance is something else. But in any event, it gives us an idea of the status that they held in New York society. Well, William McGee Seton's health began to fail when he was quite a young man, and it was recommended to him by his doctors that perhaps he take a trip and spend an extended period of time in Italy, which he decided to do in company with his wife and their children. And the Setons in New York were very close friends of a family in Livorno, or you and I would say Leghorn, Italy. The family's name were Felici. They were also an import-export family in the city of Leghorn, very, very financially well-to-do. So the Setons set sail then for Leghorn, where they stayed at the home of the Felicis. They were not there terribly long when William Seton died. He is buried to this day in the city of Leghorn, Italy, and you can go to visit his grave in the English Protestant Cemetery in Leghorn. Still, the inscription on his grave is still very discernible. William McGee Seton, merchant of New York. Mrs. Seton, of course, continued to remain with the Felici family, and she started accompanying the Felicis to Mass not too long after her husband died. There is a very beautiful shrine dedicated to Our Lady of Montenero in the city of Leghorn. If you were to go down to the end of the main street in the city, you would get on a cable car, and you'd ride the cable car up the mountain to this very beautiful shrine. Well, Mrs. Seton would accompany them to Mass very often, and she felt more and more drawn to the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. On one occasion, she was kneeling in the church of Our Lady of Montenero, assisting at Mass, came to the consecration of the Mass. The priest elevated the body of Christ contained in that sacred host. And there were some American tourists sitting a few pews behind her, but she could hear them very clearly. And the American tourist said in a rather sarcastic way, "Oh, so this is what Catholics consider to be God." And Mrs. Seton at that moment, through an indescribable grace, said, "Yes, this is God." And from that moment on, her life was changed. She left Leghorn not terribly long after that, and she had certainly made a decision mentally that she was going to become a Roman Catholic. She came back to New York. One of the first people she told about her decision that she had to become a Roman Catholic, because she felt that's where the fullness of all truth would be found. First person she told was Dr. Hobart at Trinity Church on Wall Street. Hobart was not a happy man when he heard about Mrs. Seton's decision. And there was little, if any, contact between them after she had made a final decision. So in any event, she did become a Roman Catholic. She was received into the church at St. Peter's on Barclay Street, old St. Peter's. She was disowned by her family after she became a Catholic, completely disowned by them. She was disowned by fashionable New York society after she became a Catholic. And she was really, almost as we would say, out on the streets. She had to make a living. She had to support herself and her children. And so she opened a boarding school for children in New York, which lasted only a short period of time, was not terribly successful. And through a series of circumstances, she decided she would leave New York and move to Baltimore and try the same thing in Baltimore. In other words, open a boarding school for children there as well. So she was established in Baltimore, and she became quite friendly with Bishop John Carroll shortly after her arrival in Baltimore. And she, as we say, was operating this boarding house, and it was not terribly long before she started gathering around her women who liked what she was doing, women of a similar mindset, who saw this as a wonderful thing to take children in and teach them during the day and allow some of them to stay there and so forth. And Bishop Carroll got the idea, well, if this is what they're going to do and what they're going to do, devote their life to, and they're so intent on it, why not form a religious community of women consisting of Mrs. Seton, who would be the superior, and those women who had joined her in this enterprise, who would become the first nucleus, the first sisters. And that is precisely what happened. Now today, on Packet Street in downtown Baltimore, you can go into the very chapel where Mother Seton professed her vows, along with, of course, the other women who would join her in this initial undertaking, where they professed their vows before Bishop John Carroll. It stands today right next to the house that she lived in, and it would be on the grounds of what had originally been St. Mary's Seminary on Packet Street in downtown Baltimore. Still a very lovely, beautiful chapel for you to go in and visit at any time. So they assumed a unique garb. They called themselves the Sisters of Charity, taking the same rule and generally the same lifestyle as the Sisters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul, who were known for centuries in Paris. They were the sisters, you know, who wore the large white bonnets. Catherine Laboureau would have been a member of them, and their mother house is on the Rue de Bac in Paris, and they're so closely associated with the devotion of Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal, the apparitions that Catherine Laboureau had in that famous chapel. Well, this would be the same American idea of that community of the Sisters of Charity. They did not remain in Baltimore terribly long. They decided that they would go to a more rural setting where they would open a school and where they would have a greater chance to grow and to expand. And so from Baltimore, they went to the rather small hamlet of Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is not terribly far from Harrisburg, not terribly far from the famous battlefield of Gettysburg. And there in Emmitsburg, Maryland, as we know so well, we had the beginnings of the parochial school system in the United States with Mother Elizabeth Seton and her sisters. Those Sisters of Charity were ultimately to divide into five specific groups. They were to scatter all over the United States and even to Canada. They were to attract thousands and thousands of women over the years, all because of a woman who saw the light of the Catholic faith herself. Elizabeth Bailey Seton became a saint of the church. She was canonized by Pope Paul VI in 1975. Another interesting fellow from the 18th, or the 19th century, rather, would be a man by the name of Orestes Bronson. He was probably one of the most original thinking minds to come into the church in 19th century America. He worked his way in through a process of thinking. Became a Unitarian, then he became a Presbyterian, then he became an Episcopalian, and finally he came to the fullness of faith, which is Catholicism. He did have a very brilliant mind. He was the editor of a publication which he called Bronson's Quarterly Review. And Bronson's Quarterly Review carried political articles, literary articles. It carried articles on philosophy. It carried articles on religion. And it carried articles on the social mores of American culture. Very intellectual journal, very well circulated. And Orestes Bronson was the editor. As a Catholic, I think we would have to say in many respects he became a very conservative thinker. And he was very highly regarded. When Cardinal John Henry Newman was thinking of establishing the Catholic University of Ireland in Dublin, he seriously considered Orestes Bronson to become one of his faculty members. Well, Bronson was an ongoing thorn in the side to Archbishop John Hughes of New York, because he would write some rather sarcastic articles about the Archbishop in his political journal, telling him essentially how to run the archdiocese in so many ways. So it's interesting, on the campus of Fordham University in New York, we have a statue of Archbishop Hughes, and we have a bust of Orestes Bronson. The interesting thing is that the two of them are facing in opposite directions. They were not exactly friends, to say the least. But Bronson still is a very, very interesting catch for the Catholic Church in the 19th century. Also, as the century was coming to a close, there was a man by the name of Lewis T. Watson, a former Episcopalian minister who came into the Catholic faith. He was better known as Father Paul James Francis Watson, and as an Episcopalian minister, he founded the Friars of the Atonement in Greymore, New York, in 1886. He was one of the earliest leaders of the ecumenical movement. He was the founder of the Church Unity Octave movement back in 1908, and he shocked the world, I think we can say, when he announced that he and his entire religious community in 1909 were becoming members of the Catholic faith. Father Watson was ordained a Catholic priest, and he remained the superior of the Greymore community until his death. Harvard-educated Selden Peabody Delaney was another interesting individual. He was the rector of the very fashionable Church of St. Mary of the Virgin in New York City and a convert to Catholicism. He later became a priest and a well-read Catholic author. James Kent Stone was another famous convert to the faith in the 19th century. He was the grandson of the Episcopalian Bishop of Boston, Stone, and he was, on his mother's side, descended from Chancellor Kent, who wrote Kent's famous commentaries on Blackstone's Laws of England. He was an Episcopalian minister. He had been the president of Kenyon College in Ohio. He was then the president of Hobart and William Smith College in Geneva, New York. A married man who became a widower with two small children. He entered the Catholic faith through an intellectual process. His young daughters were given to a religious group of sisters who placed them in foster homes. Kent Stone himself became a Catholic. He became a polished priest, and after looking for a somewhat more austere way of life, he became a Passionist priest, and he was known as Father Fidelis Kent Stone of the Cross, a nationally known preacher and a nationally known lecturer as well, a wonderful, wonderful convert to the faith. James Roosevelt Bailey, the nephew of Mother Seton, a former Episcopalian minister, a cousin to both Presidents Roosevelt, became a Catholic priest. He became the Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. He became an Archbishop of Baltimore, Maryland. Literary figures have also ranked very high in the number of important converts over the years. F. Marion Crawford, probably one of the most famous novelists of his time, was converted to the church in 1880. Joel Chandler Harris, who gave us those famous Uncle Remus stories that delighted millions, entered the church in 1908. Rose Hawthorne Lathrop, the daughter of the famous author and novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne, became a Catholic after her husband George Lathrop of the Atlantic Monthly had died. Mrs. Lathrop, of course, went on to found the very famous Hawthorne Dominican Sisters for the care of those with incurable cancer. Joyce Kilmer is a poet whom we have all read in the course of our life, another wonderful convert. He died on a French battlefield during the First World War. Fulton Ousler, whom we've had occasion to mention before, a convert to the faith. Later in life, his daughter April Ousler Armstrong would follow him into the church. Fulton Ousler wrote the greatest story ever told, the greatest faith ever known. Very, very devout man. Robert G. Anderson, the author of Cathedral Books. Artemus Ward, the famous humorist. Frances Parkinson Kyes, who wrote so many, many delightful novels in her long life, all became converts to the Catholic faith. In the world of the military, we have people like Admiral William S. Benson, whom we've also mentioned before. He was the chief of naval operations during the First World War. General James Longstreet, one of the leading military figures of the Confederacy. General William Stark Rosecrans, again, one of the leading figures, military figures in the Union Army. And as we mentioned before, his younger brother Sylvester became a Catholic and a priest and the Bishop of Columbus, Ohio. In the field of law, we have people like William Jackson Shipman, who not only became a Catholic, but also became one of the editors of the very famous Catholic Encyclopedia. William Robinson, a very brilliant man who was one time a professor of law at Yale University, was an Episcopalian minister. He was the minister of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He left the Episcopalian faith, became a Roman Catholic layman, and served as dean of the law school at Catholic University of America for many years. Another famous convert to the faith was a man by the name of John Mitchell. John Mitchell came from Illinois, but he made his home also in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He became the president of the United Mine Workers of America and played a very distinguished role in the anthracite coal negotiations, ending that famous coal strike in 1902. Haywood Broune, one of the famous Algonquin wits, the father of the sportscaster Haywood Hale Broune, became a convert to the Catholic faith, largely through the influence of Monsignor Fulton J. Sheen. Another one of Bishop Sheen's famous converts was Mrs. Claire Booth Luce. Claire, who was married to Henry Luce of the Time Life Empire, became a Catholic after her husband's death. Her young daughter had been killed in an automobile accident, and she couldn't reconcile herself to it. And she said, "Why would a good God ever take my daughter away?" And she called a Jesuit priest, and she said, "I have to talk to you." And the priest said, "Well, all right, that's fine, I'm glad, but really, I'm not the man to help you. The man you want to talk to is Bishop Sheen." And Mrs. Luce called Bishop Sheen. "Why could a good God have done this to me?" "Well, maybe he did it to you to draw you more closely to himself, to show you that he wants something more from you in life." That was the initial argument that Bishop Sheen used. And beginning with that argument, he brought Mrs. Luce ultimately into the church. A very brilliant convert, to say the least. Fritz Kreisler, the famous violinist, had been born in Germany, came to this country, was also a convert of Bishop Sheen. Irving Cobb, many of you may remember, he was a humorist and a satirist. His daughter, Buffy Cobb, also a famous woman in her own right, became one of Fulton Sheen's converts. And Mrs. Cobb, the wife of Irving Cobb, followed her daughter into the church. Martha Moore Avery, a pioneer of Marxism in the United States, a devoted socialist. Dorothy Day, who had been part of the United Workers of the World and raised in just a nominal Episcopalian family, became a very devout Roman Catholic in later years. One of the most unexpected conversions to the faith, I suppose, was Colonel Horace Attlee Mann. Colonel Mann was a native of the state of Tennessee. He was the son of a Methodist minister. He became a very prominent Washington attorney in his day, and when Al Smith ran for president of the United States in 1928, Horace Mann and his wife led a virulently anti-Catholic campaign against Governor Al Smith. Interestingly, after the years went by, long after that 1928 presidential campaign, Colonel Mann and his wife began to think through their position. They began to seriously ask themselves, what was this anti-Catholic bigotry all about? And they began to conclude it really was all about nothing at all. And I would think that Colonel Mann and his wife, because of the religious background that they came from, were people who, through a slow process but a very decided process, prayed their way into the fullness of faith, which is Catholicism. Colonel Mann and his wife were both received into the church. Another convert, we can include him with converts, though he actually was born a Catholic, would be Louis Boudens. Louis Boudens came from Indianapolis, Indiana. He left the church, became the editor of the Communist Daily Worker, and ultimately came back, reconciled by Monsignor Fulton Sheen. These are just a few, my dear friends, of some of the very famous people who joined the Catholic faith from colonial days up to the late 20th century. They prayed their way in. They fought their way in. They were all testimonials to grace. They saw the fullness of faith, that faith which had been planted in this country in colonial days, that faith which grew, that faith which developed, that faith which, through the grace of Almighty God, was a phenomenal success story. We hope we've tried to share with you some of the highlights of that success story in this series, and we hope as a result of this series that your own devotion to your faith will become stronger and that you will thank God each and every day of your life if you have been born into the fullness of faith, which is Christ's one holy Catholic and apostolic church. God bless you, and God love you all.